All right, welcome to another episode of ICU Doc Talk. Thanks for listening. For this podcast, I got a really good email from a listener, and there's so many good questions and good topics here. I'm basically going to just read portions of this email, and I think that's going to be the whole episode here because it's such a great email with so many good, just rich veins to talk about. And in this email, this person said it's okay to talk about stuff, to answer questions on the podcast. So I'm going to do that. So this is from Jacob, last name withheld. And there's just a lot of stuff here. And I'll just kind of start reading some portions of his email, and then we'll just dive in to the topics. So Jacob said he just listened to the latest mini episode that I put up about Palestine and Israel, which I'm not going to talk about today or probably ever again. Just to not scare you off. This is relevant to his question. So thanks for sharing your views and books and that you've read to form your opinion. I do not know a lot about the conflict in Israel, but your podcast gave me some baseline insights and I have been able to learn more through other avenues since, which is such a perfect thing, right? Like, so I shared my thoughts about what's going on and I don't have a full picture. Of course I don't. Most people do not. I would say nobody has a full picture. So that's exactly what you should do. Listen to my opinion, even though I'm not an expert on that. Listen to many opinions and go look at other avenues and think for yourself. But one of the meat of what, one of the things I want to talk about today is Jacob goes on saying, one thing that I wanted to ask is how do you navigate harder conversations such as Israel and COVID with family or coworkers who have opposite views? Jacob goes on to say, I am the younger person in these situations. So there's always a power dynamic, and I usually assume I do not know enough to disagree, even if I feel strongly against it. I usually just nod my head and go along with it. With COVID, I've gotten to be more outspoken when it comes to correcting family members, but I have been shocked to see how many coworkers at the hospital believe in misinformation. Just curious how you navigate these conversations. I just think this is such a great question, and I want to dive into this. So my first answer to this. So how to have hard conversations. I think that's kind of one of the main topics today. Jacob asks a lot of other good questions about ECMO, which I'm going to get to as well. Having hard conversations with family, coworkers, maybe even patients, if you're working in healthcare or customers or whatever, in whatever environment. So rule number one is you must know your audience, right? You have to recognize context is everything. What is your audience? Who are you talking to? You have to feel that person out about where they're at. All of us are on, we're all in our own journeys. I know it's like cheesy, but we're on our little journeys of understanding of many things. Like we all have our strengths and weaknesses of what we understand about the world, whether that's, there's tons of stuff, right? Some people know tons about this thing and or other things, whatever, you know what I'm saying. So we're on our different journeys. So you gotta see where people are at. And not only that, you gotta see like where experience, you know, also matters, what people have been through, and their experiences also matter a lot. Something that I've realized as I've gotten a little older. You gotta know where someone's at. And what is the context? Where are you? Are you at work? Are you talking with a coworker? Or are you arguing with a stranger on the internet? The reason that matters is how much are you willing to engage with this person and how much are you willing to push on them? And are you going to throw away all the social capital that you have built up in that relationship with that person, right? If you have a coworker who you have a good relationship with, but maybe they, I don't know, don't believe in climate change or something like that, is it really worth it to engage in a conversation with that person and break, you know, break down on maybe a good functional relationship that you have with that person, maybe even a friendship, whatever, acquaintance? Is it worth it? So is it worth it to get, so know your audience, and then is it worth it to engage on this thing? You don't have to, obviously you can't pick up every engagement, every argument, which, or debate, I should say, a disagreement, you can't engage in every time you come across someone who doesn't see things a little different than you, or you just can't get through your day. So do you have the time? Is it worth the cost to you to do this? Is another thing to really consider before you even engage in a conversation with somebody that maybe doesn't agree with you, or has worldview or an opinions that you believe are harmful to them or other people around them. So I think those are three things to keep in mind. No, who is your audience? Is it worth it? And do you have the time to do it? Another thing to matter is tone matters a lot. The tone, your tone of voice, and how you're approaching this with someone. It matters maybe even more than what you're saying. Particularly if someone's really charged up or extremely opinionated. If you come in with like a cynical tone or a sarcastic tone or a mocking tone, it's over. It's also pointless. You're not going to change anybody's minds with being condescending or smug tone, right? Which is something that I try to work on, because I think I can actually be quite smug and arrogant. So that's something I think a character flaw of my own that I try to work on, which I don't think I've made any progress really. Let me give you an example. So so the other day, not the other day, I don't know, this is months ago, I was with a colleague who I really like and still like, and like very much like, and I even think me and him have a very similar worldview probably. And he started talking about, what were we talking about? I don't even remember the exact substance of the conversation. It wasn't even controversial, but he said something like, well, that's what you get, you know, when we live in a country where we have too much time on our hands, or a kind of excess time, then people start worrying about frivolous things, which is what we were talking about. And anyway, I was like, well, what about all the Americans that, you know, don't have excess and don't have, you know, that are living in poverty? Like I took this like hard right turn, and cause I was kind of like, I kind of took issue with the fact that like, oh, all Americans live in excess and have all this time. It's like, not all Americans, right? There's many that are impoverished. So I like went on, I was like ready to like jump in, and with this weird tone, like this very kind of, I was almost like aggressive, and I was like, and I kind of noted that the tone of the room changed, and it was kind of like, whoa, what? And I was like, whoa, what am I doing? why am I doing this? And I like eased back, and I was like, whew, like take a breath, man. Like to myself, I was just like, what? Just having a casual conversation. I don't need to like jump into all the impoverished in America. Like it was, I don't know. I was just like, it was a self-reflective moment. Like I don't need to do this. This is weird that I'm taking this conversation to this other place. Like this is unneeded. This isn't, not every moment is a teaching moment or a learning moment. It's like, so that's just kind of example. Like, is it worth it to do this in this moment? So yeah, so the tone of a conversation really matters a lot. Some people like to pick fights. They try to fish and they pick fights, right? They try to pick ideological fights at work. And sometimes you need to recognize who these people are in your life and decide if it's worth it. Like they'll, you know, people will throw out feelers out there being like, oh man, what's an example? Like I had a coworker who, I won't get too specific, but like, someone will try to throw out a line about like something that happened in politics, and it's clear that their take is leaning ideologically one way or the other. So they're like putting out a line out, right? And they're trying to maybe provoke you into a conversation, either to agree with them or to disagree. And it's sometimes important to identify who these people are in your spaces, in your family, and at work. Another big part of this is you need to have boundaries. Like, and boundaries apply to different people at different times. Like I have coworkers that I will not have political or world conversations with, period. I will not engage with them. Doesn't mean I don't like them at all. I honestly like every single one of my colleagues. And I have many, many colleagues. I work with lots of people. There's nobody I genuinely do not like, but there are people that after getting to know them, that I'm like, oh, I have a boundary for this person. I will not talk about politics with this person. That will not happen. And then I have other colleagues that like, oh yeah, I'll talk politics all day with them. Not necessarily because we're like always on the same page, but it's how we engage with one another. It's good. We both benefit from it, from hearing each other's opinions. So you got to be selective. You must be selective. All right. And then moving on, Jacob, in this email, he mentioned about being, he's usually the younger person in these situations, so there's always a power dynamic, and that is a very true thing. There are power dynamics in conversations all the time. He says, I usually assume I do not know enough to disagree, even if I feel strongly against it. I usually just nod my head and go along with it. So it depends on the conversation. Experience does matter. And I feel like that I've gotten a little older, and I'm not like super old, but I'm not super young. I don't like to share my age because I don't want to give too many specifics about my personal life. But I was telling my wife the other day, I think when you're truly old, when you're actually finally are old, because everybody thinks they're old, right? It's like hilarious when I see people in their like 30s that think they're old because they some sort of pop cultural reference. It's just funny. You are truly old when you stop talking about how old you are. That's when you're old. That's when you've arrived at old age, when you stop talking about it and stop kind of like flexing how old you are. Anyway, that's beside the point. Here's my point. When it comes to stuff like, I think, whether it's politics or geopolitics or medicine or COVID and things like that, age doesn't have to matter in a conversation. Facts and presenting of things, that's what matters. You see people on debating all the time. I see people younger than me debating on TikTok or other things, and they're extremely good and effective at it. And age doesn't necessarily matter. Maybe it does. But it doesn't necessarily matter when you're talking about factual things, when you're trying to talk about factual things and actually have a good discourse. Here's one of the most, so I got two things to say. Two of the most effective tools, I think, after going through all that stuff, if you choose to engage in conversation with people, you need to engage in good faith. Okay, if you want to not be in good faith and you want to just outrage and argue with people, then go ahead and do that. You'll have your reward, which is just feeling toxic. You're just going to be toxic afterwards. And it's like arguing with trolls on the internet. You feel awful afterwards. I've done it. I'm not going to say I haven't done that. I try to avoid it. And maybe if you're even listening to this, maybe you even see some toxic engagements sometimes I get into in comment sections on TikTok or Instagram. I try not to. But I call it a troll crush. When you have a crush on a troll, you can't get them out of your heads from something they said, and you want to dig in. Like, I'm no better than anybody else. I do it too. But what was my point? I'm forgetting. Oh yeah. So if you want to have that kind of toxic conversation with someone, go for it. Dig in deep, but it's miserable, and you will be miserable afterwards. You know it. If you've done it, which I'm sure you probably have, how do you feel afterwards? You don't feel good. You might feel a little bit satisfied or something after you block that person or like finally get them that final, right? Oh, I showed them. They don't feel it that way. They feel that they showed you. You both feel that you showed each other. You're both miserable. You're both toxic. So there's no point in engaging conversations like that. So you need to engage in good faith. And then I was getting back to, I think, two of the most effective things to engage with somebody. So if you're engaging with somebody and they make, this is so simple. Seriously, just remember this one thing. If they make a point, if they're like, well, there's this, simply asking them to defend that point. You don't need to respond. You don't need to react to what they said. Like, okay, let's, say someone says, oh, the vaccine is, is killing athletes. You just say, oh, what makes you say that? And what you're doing is so I think that's a good way to go about it, because you're making them defend their claims, right? And if they're making false claims, they can't easily defend them. And you can take them by the hand and lead them down their claim, and you can show them where they've erred, if they are also engaging with you in good faith as well, which they may not be. And if they're not, then it doesn't work. And this is where you got to set up a boundary, right? This is where the boundaries come in. This is where you figure out, okay, I can't talk to this person about this subject anymore. But my point is, say like, oh, athletes are dropping down the vaccine. It's like, oh, why do you believe it? But by the way, this takes time. That's why I said you must determine if you have the time and energy to do this, because this takes time. But it also, it means you care about that person. If you're doing this with someone in your life, you care about them. There's no doubt about it. If you're having a conversation like this with somebody, you care about them. Truly, if you're doing it in good faith and not just to like, I'm right, not to feel right, you definitely care about. This is caring for somebody, taking them down this pathway. Like, okay, and I'm not just talking about anti-vax people. This applies to whatever. If someone's like, oh, yeah, athletes are dropping dead. You know, you just ask them to defend it. Where did you read that? Why do you believe that? And then they'll say their thing. And then it'd be like, well, what is that? You know, take that. And that's the Socratic method. That is what the Socratic method is. So you're helping learn together and you're learning from that person and you're learning about the way that they think. And they also may have some accurate information that you don't know about as well. Because what I find is a lot of people that have distorted opinions from misinformation, disinformation, a lot of that misinformation is mixed with factual things. That's when misinformation is so effective. When it's twisted, it has nuggets of truth and accurate information, and then that gets recontextualized and then rebranded, and then people get confused. But you'll probably learn from them as well, and you'll learn why they think the way that they learn. And now you cannot expect conversations like this to turn. The person will not turn 180 to your view after the conversation. That will not happen. There is no way that will happen. But the best case scenario in a conversation like this is you listen to one another, you understand why that person thinks that way, and you have good feelings about one another. That's the point. That's the point. And then you establish a relationship that you can return to and explore things together and even have trust. And that's what discourse is. That's what discourse is. That's what helpful, beautiful discourse is, which is so hard to find these days. You can find it though, right? You can. And you can even have conversations like this with people on the internet if you have the time. But man, does this take a lot of energy. It takes so much time and energy to do this with somebody. But age doesn't have to matter. You need to be accurate as well. You need to be informed. And even if you're not informed, you don't need to be informed about a lot of stuff to employ this method, to just ask people to defend why they think that. You don't need to be informed. So say someone says something and you're like, that seems like a kind of an outrageous claim, but I don't know enough about this. So you don't need, you don't need to nod along with them. And again, tone matters. If you say, well, where'd you read that? Like my tone, where'd you read that? That's a confrontational tone. I can take those same words and say, oh, where did you read that? Well, that sounded a little condescending too. Maybe I can't do it because maybe I'm too condescending. They're like, oh, where did you read that? I'm trying to come up with the right tone with that phrase. Anyway, you get my point. The tone really matters here. But you don't even need to be that well informed. If someone's making a claim, ask them to defend it. That's what you're doing. Where did you read that? Why do you think that way? You're asking them to defend it. Here's the sad truth of it. Most people, from my experience, that spread misinformation about anything or have a bad understanding, their assertions break under the tiniest amount of scrutiny because they have not thought things through and they have not thought things for themselves. Seriously, literally just asking them one question, like, why do you believe? Where did you come to that conclusion? They're broken. and a lot of times they'll just backpedal out of it. Right. That's sadly is what happens a lot. It is the older and more experienced I get, the more baffled I am at how poorly people form their opinions on such limited information and without accurately understanding and applying critical thinking to things. It's really shocking. It's really shocking. People are terrible at weighing risk in their minds. We are fooled, and we are fooled and led in our minds in so many different ways by so many different media sources. Just a single headline just will fool. It happens to me. I'm no exception to this. And what social media has done to our critical thinking skills is just, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's just, I think it's depressing if you think about it too much. So there's a lot of books that can help you think through these things. and help you with, you know, how to think about the way you think, and then how to help other people think. That I just want to talk about. So two books that have helped me a lot, I've actually already talked about in this podcast, so I'll just mention them so you can go back and listen to them if you want. The first one is a big famous book, Thinking Fast and Slow by Dan Kahneman. That's episode 2 of my podcast. And then another one is called Calling Bullshit by Bergstrom, and that's on episode 3 of this podcast. You can go back and listen to those if you want to read those books about kind of the way we think and also understanding statistical like chicanery and trickery. But I do want to talk about two other books that I think will help Jacob and help other people as well. And they're very readable. They're really, really, and they're really good audiobooks too. One of the books I want to talk about is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe by Dr. Stephen Novella. He does a podcast called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe as well. It's a great podcast, which I've listened to just a couple episodes. So this book is like the ultimate guide to recognizing logical fallacies. Now, I'm not saying in a conversation with people, you can't just call out all of their logical fallacies. It's a great way to just shut down the conversation. It's a great way to feel very superior to them. And I do this all the time, because I'm can be kind of smug myself, you know. If you want to shut down the conversation, it's fine. You can just be like, yeah, it's a false equivalency. But it's okay to name them. Again, tone matters. So if someone says something, you can be like, well, I think that's kind of a false equivalency. And then explain how it's a false equivalency. That will help people understand. But yeah, but you can't just sit there and just call out all the logical fallacies that people are making in an argument, or else, number one, they'll just hate you. It's just not very effective. Because what's the point of doing this? Is it to feel superior? Then do that. Then you'll have your reward. You feel superior. But the point of discourse and actual proper debate is to develop a relationship with that person, come to understanding with that person. That should be the goal. That should be the goal. So anyway, this book, I've read a lot of books like this about strategies to cut through the unbelievable amount of nonsense that surrounds us all the time. And this can really help you to put an even footing on reality-based thinking. There are innumerable pitfalls and biases and the logical fallacies that we all fall victim to. You know, not just the person you're talking to, but yourself. We use imperfect senses and reasoning through the lens of culture and language and anecdote, and we grope wildly in the darkness to even begin to understand what truth is and what error is. It's really easy to fall into despair during this age of conspiracy theory and what I've started to call ignorance positivity, which is becoming mainstream, and armchair pseudoscientists and hosts of disinformation machine. But this book, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, it really shows you that there's hope. There's hope. So Novella and his friends, the author, they walk you through the very important ways in which someone uses logical fallacies to prove their point. So scroll on any social media platform and you'll see the fallacies all over the place, from ad hominem, right, to attack, which is attacking the person. Ad hoc analysis, which is what's ad hoc? That's like moving the goalposts, changing your debate after new information. After you get a good rebuttal, the person kind of twists and changes their debate. That's ad hoc analysis. False analogies, false equivalencies, false dichotomies, false continuums, appeal to authority, appeal to antiquity. It's one of my favorites, right? People are like, oh, tobacco's not bad. It's a plant. Like, no, it's bad. Guns are made from metal. That comes from the earth, and those are bad. Anyway, appeal to nature, another one. Oh, wait, I mixed those ones up. I was talking about appeal to nature. Appeal to antiquity is also used all the time, right? Oh, well, it was written in the Constitution. It doesn't mean it's correct. That's an appeal to antiquity. Straw man arguments, the list goes on and on. You see that they're littered everywhere. It's really important to recognize these fallacies so you can easily cut them down in a debate, like I said, but you can do it in a good way. I have found one of the easiest ways, as I said, to debate someone is not to argue with them, but simply ask that they provide evidence and clarify to support their claims. A house of cards of faulty reasoning and debate fallacy will easily collapse with even the slightest interrogation. Confirmation bias and shortcut heuristics are a major source of error in our own thinking. We are like a heuristic is like, you know, is a mental shortcut. It's like a mental scaffolding you built. It's a construct you built in your mind to understand something, and it's built upon shaky assumptions often. We ourselves are an enormous source of bias and flawed thinking. We should doubt ourselves first. When we correct those who embrace science, denialism, and pseudoscience, we should do so humbly and with grace, because all of us at times have fallen prey to our own biases and backwards thinking. It's happened to you. It's happened to them. The author covers a slew of pseudoscience stuff out there, like UFOs and ghosts and creationism and GMO safety and even the idea of consciousness. He does a little bit on fake news and journalism as well. He really leaves no stone unturned. It's a really good book. For me, skepticism, which that's what this is, right? This is what skepticism is. Skepticism is not cynicism, but rather trying to do our best to support our beliefs with evidence that is derived by the scientific method. There is truth. We know this because many things are discovered by this established method. The truth is just a really, really, really difficult thing to demonstrate, and we mostly show it by proving error first and honing in on the truth in the messy scientific way that is the hallmark of discovery. Personally, I'm not a pure skeptic or a pure empiricist. If you know me, you know I'm not a pure skeptic. I enjoy my silly little beliefs that I have, that I have no evidence for, and that's perfectly okay, as long as I don't use the lazy tactics of pseudoscience to try to prove that my beliefs are correct and impose them on others. That's the difference. I believe someone can have both skepticism and faith, like I've talked about in other podcasts, at the same time, as long as they remain compartmentalized, I think. And that's a hard thing to do. The other book I just wanted to mention is called Think Again by Adam Grant. Really good book. This was published, when was it? 2021. It's about 300 pages. I'll talk about this book. I'll just ask a question. Why would we laugh at someone using Windows 95, but we don't bat an eye at our own ideas that were formulated in like 1995 that still form our worldview? Think Again, is a great quick read about questioning the old scripts that we read from and getting ourselves to rethink everything. The author, named Adam Grant, keeps an engaging pace full of research and anecdotes trying to convince the reader of the joy of being wrong and the growth that comes from questioning our worldview and how we come to conclusions. When we are ideologues, we typically act in three flavors: preacher, prosecutor, or politician. We are either acolytes of an idea, and prosecute others that don't have those same ideas, or try to convince them someone out of our own self-interest, like a politician does. The author encourages us to engage our scientific mind instead. Speak to others in a way that gets them and yourself to rethink assumptions and ask the important questions. How do you know? Right? That's back to my main point. How do you know that? Seriously, that's the first thing in your arsenal with conversations. How do you know that? You're really confident and thinking that athletes are dropping dead from the vaccine. How do you know that? That's a nice way of saying things, I think, in a non-smug way to really open up. How do you know that? You know, confirmation and desirability bias infiltrates all of our decision making. There is a reason the author talks about BlackBerry couldn't compete with Apple. And it was because the founder was stuck thinking that his product was what people wanted. It was a resistance to change and a death grip on bias that resulted in the demise of an enormously successful device, which BlackBerry was. Steve Jobs even thought it was a bad idea to make iPods into phones, but he listened to those under him and became convinced. According to the author, I haven't fact-checked that story. Men constantly overestimate their leadership skills, while women tend to do the opposite. As opposed to the Dunning-Kruger effect that is rampant among the misinformed, it is unbelievable. So the Dunning-Kruger effect, it's in so much effect that people that are clearly influenced, that are having the Dunning-Kruger effect, will then accuse other people of being under the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's insane. But also the imposter syndrome creeps up in like academics or in your job. It's when you go from novice to amateur that we particularly begin to overestimate our expertise. Novice to amateur. Arrogance is ignorance plus conviction. That's what arrogance is. Ignorance plus conviction. That's what you're seeing with lots of people. The author also argues that the imposter syndrome can be a benefit. It is highly motivating and compels humility. So it's interesting. One can both be humble and confident in their ability to adapt and relearn. It's wise to recognize the difference between relationship conflict and task conflict. The latter, task conflict, is desirable as it creates a marketplace of ideas and is exactly how the ever arguing Wright brothers invented flight, according to the author. We should also be careful of being a logic bully. That was what I was talking about. Someone who is informed and tries to hit you over the head with pristine logic. That's what I was talking about. People don't want to hear about how good you are at pointing out their logical fallacies. It doesn't convince anyone of anything. And rather than using the straw man argument, which is you know, taking someone's someone makes a point and then you make a ridiculous straw man point and you argue that, and that diverts away from the core argument. Rather than using the straw man argument, the author talks about the steel man argument, which is you take your opponent's best made point and you validate it, and then you explore from there. That is another huge, huge tool. So going back to how do you have these difficult conversations with people, you ask them, how do you know that? And then you take their best made point. There's something you can find common ground with. You validate that point, and then you explore from there. Now you're swimming in the same direction with this person. It's highly disarming, and it creates discourse. A single line of reasoning is a conversation. A single line of reasoning. Any more than that is prosecution. There's all these lines of reasoning that now you're prosecuting a person. You don't want to prosecute them. We should engage in something called motivational interviewing. That's kind of the Socratic method, where we explore how someone knows what they know. That's how you engage with people. The greatest advice is that we should focus on values and not opinions. Values create common ground and open discourse. In the end, do not be afraid to be wrong. Rather, we should take joy in being wrong to ever sharpen our understanding of the world and the people that are in our world. So anyway, for Jacob and for everybody listening, just to summarize, how do you engage these conversations? Just to summarize what I've talked about is, I can't go back and listen, and I'm just going to kind of, just a quick summary. Make sure it's worth your time. Understand your audience. Make sure you have that energy and that time. Maybe make sure you have boundaries set up with a person and that you're talking within those boundaries. And then when you do engage with that person, ask them how they know what they know. And then find a common ground, find their best argument, validate it with them, and then explore from there. Find common ground and focus on values rather than opinions. That is a place to start. I think that's the right place to start. It's hard. This is a hard, what I'm talking about, what we're talking about today, this is a hard thing to do. And if you do it, this is how you should. This is love language. This is how you show you care for somebody. This is how you care for somebody, by doing this, rather than feeling right and superior and shutting down the conversation. That's, you know, that's bad. That's toxic. Okay, anyway, let's move on from that topic, which was great. I really enjoyed talking about this stuff. I'm going back to Jacob's email. It's awesome. he's moved on to something else. This is more medicine stuff. All right. So he says he has a medical question about ECMO, which is a heart-lung bypass machine. He saw it for the first time at the ER and instantly thought of the podcast because I talk about ECMO. I'm an ECMO practitioner. One thing that stumped me is whether or not ECMO can be given to someone in cardiac arrest and ROSC. ROSC stands for Return of Spontaneous Circulation. Wait, let me rephrase this question, or repeat it. One thing that stumped me is whether or not ECMO can be given to someone in cardiac arrest and ROSC never occurred. So what he's asking is, can you put someone in ECMO even though you haven't had a pulse back? That's what he's asking. Apparently, there was the slightest bit of cardiac activity on the ultrasound, and that justified its use, but there was still not a sustained rhythm compatible with life. To my knowledge, they never got ROSC, or, you know, like a pulse back, and put them on ECMO, and CPR was stopped as well. I know ECMO replaces the heart and lungs, but doesn't the heart still need to beat effectively? They went up to the ICU after the ECMO was put in place, so I have no idea what happened after that. A lot of us were confused, so wanted to get your thoughts. I am terrified of violating HIPAA. You haven't, Jacob. I would not share the email. That was enough detail. You definitely have not violated HIPAA, and I'm comfortable sharing your email and what happened. So let's talk about this this case. So I'm going to give a full answer to this question because it's really important what Jacob's asking. But the short answer is, okay, can you put – so for those that aren't familiar, ECMO is a heart-lung bypass machine. It's like the most advanced life-saving measure in modern medicine. Put someone on this machine. So one of the meat of – I think one of the questions he's asking is, can you put someone on ECMO when their heart is not beating? I think what Jacob's getting at too is like, what's the point? If their heart is not beating, if it's not moving, and then their heart is, you know, maybe it's not a recoverable situation. So why put them on ECMO? The short answer. So I'll give a long answer, but the short answer is, Kate, can you put someone on ECMO whose heart is not beating? The short answer is yes, and it depends on the context. It depends on the context so much here. I'll share a story that'll help me get to the answer to this question. So this is when I was like a resident. Or a fellow or something, and I didn't know a whole lot about ECMO. I mean, I knew what it was, and I, you know, I was familiar with it, But it gets vague about its use and how to use it and the ethics. All that stuff gets vague, particularly if you're not an ECMO practitioner. And even when you are an ECMO practitioner yourself, it still is vague and messy because it's just not an exact practice. And it's very institutionally dependent. But anyway, there's a patient who had a young woman who had methamphetamine cardiomyopathy and got a heart transplant after she quit. Yeah, she was young, so she got a heart transplant. But then that heart transplant went into rejection, right? It had her own immune response started to, you know, attack the grafted heart, the new heart. And so she was back in the hospital in heart failure, pretty severe heart failure. And then she coded. She had cardiac arrest. And this was on the floor, not in the ICU, like the medical wards. So she coded, and then we were doing chest compressions. And she was put on ECMO, VA ECMO. What we're talking about here, the use of ECMO, we call it ECPR, and I've done an episode about it, is ECPR, ECMO CPR, which is very different from putting someone on ECMO in a more controlled environment for something like COVID, right? Very, very different situations. So this is ECPR. You're doing chest compressions, and while you're resuscitating them, you put them on ECMO. So this patient was put on ECMO. We brought him to the ICU. We did an echo of her heart, looked at her heart. It wasn't moving. So it was not moving at all. So me being, you know, a little inexperienced at ECMO, there was a cardiologist there and I don't even remember. And I was like, what are we doing? Like, why are we, you know, I had this like feeling like, why is this patient on ECMO? What are we doing? What I was implying is this is pointless. And maybe I was implying this is unethical. We should stop this and let the patient pass away. But I remember a cardiology fellow or a attending or something was kind of like, well, you never know. You know, we'll give some immunosuppression and maybe the white cells infiltrating the heart muscle that are causing the heart, you know, the cardiomyopathy and maybe the heart block, maybe it'll quiet down over the next couple of days and the cardiac function will return. And that person was right. The cardiologist was correct. And the heart function did return. That patient came off ECMO and left the hospital alive. They lost their use of they had to have a leg amputation, unfortunately, because the ECMO can sometimes cause decreased perfusion to a leg and it can threaten the limb. Anyway, so that story is an example. So ECPR, ECMO CPR, particularly, so when talking about the heart, if the heart is at a standstill and they're otherwise a good candidate to be put on ECMO, and not getting ROSC, the return of spontaneous circulation, not getting a pulse back, you can put that person on ECMO because their heart can be stunned. The myocardium itself can be stunned for a variety of reasons. So that person that Jacob's talking about could have coded, had cardiac arrest because of like a heart attack. And that's why they arrested it. And that person, a heart attack, is a really, really good, who codes and it's witnessed and comes into the hospital and then does chest compressions, is a very good candidate for ECMO because you can put them on ECMO. ECMO provides, it provides the function of the heart and the lungs. Basically, it continues to perfuse the organs and keep the brain and the kidneys and all the organs alive while the heart is not working. And then a cardiologist can go in and remove the obstruction from the coronary artery. And then over a couple of days, that heart function can return. And that person could come off ECMO. So you do not need, in that situation with ROSC, or sorry, with no ROSC in ECPR situation, you don't have any cardiac activity and you have not achieved ROSC, you can put that patient on ECMO for sure. And I've done it myself. If that person is otherwise a good candidate, what I mean by that is the ongoing chest compressions, the resuscitation cannot be more than an hour because chest compressions, what are chest compressions doing? They're perfusing what's the point of chest compressions? It's not to resuscitate. It's not to get the heart back pumping. I used to think that before I was in medicine, and I bet other people do, before I was in med school or anything, I used to think that doing chest compressions was try to get the heart to start working again. But chest compressions are, you're pumping the heart for itself to perfuse your organs. That's why you're doing chest compressions. Now, the heart might return from that kind of stimulation, that kind of external mechanical stimulation, particularly if it's like an electrical problem. It's possible it also might help the heart. But that's not the main reason that you're doing chest compressions. You're doing chest compressions to perfuse the organs while you're trying to get the heart to pump on its own again. That's the whole reason you're doing it. So the whole point, so as I said, you you can put someone on ECMO when their heart is not moving, and stopping chest compressions is exactly what you should be doing after you put on ECMO and the circuit is running. And I've seen this before. When we put someone on ECMO and chest compressions are going on and then we're flowing well, that means I'm perfusing the organs. And then I tell whoever's doing the resuscitation, whether that's the emergency department or another staff, I say, okay, stop chest compressions. And there's always this wait, what? We can't stop. Because you're not used to it. When you're in resuscitative medicine, you don't stop chest compressions until you call it that it's over or until you get a pulse back. And in this situation, as soon as you get flow, now chest compressions are now, not only are they not necessary, but now they're harmful because there is no benefit to it. So you should stop chest compressions immediately after you have good flow on your ECMO circuit, because now you're just rattling on someone's chest and possibly breaking ribs and... So you should stop them immediately. So they must meet all other criteria. Assuming they meet other criteria and they're they've had chest compressions less than 60 minutes or less, because even with chest compression, the perfusion is still poor. And if that goes beyond 60 minutes, the chances of meaningful neurological recovery is low. And then an unwitnessed arrest, if someone is found down or without a pulse and then chest compressions are started, that person is not a candidate for ECMO because they may have been in a low flow state for 10, 20, 30 minutes before someone found them. And that person's not going to survive. Their brain is dead. So assuming they meet all other criteria for ECMO, which can be quite stringent, assuming they meet that, and then depending on the situation, if they have a cardiac standstill, like it's not moving, you certainly put them on ECMO. The heart is an incredibly dynamic organ, right? It's just a huge muscle pump, and it can come back for sure. I've seen it time and time again. It can recover. That's one of the main reasons we put people on VA ECMO, veno arterial ECMO, is to give their heart a chance to recover. And I've seen it many times. I've also seen it go the other way, where their heart doesn't recover very well, and they eventually pass away on ECMO a few days later. But it's still worth it to put them on, assuming they're a good candidate. It's still worth it to put it on. All right. Anyway, thanks again for Jacob for all of his great questions. For a great discussion today. I've already talked about some books. I'm just going to mention some some sci-fi book recommendations. I recommend. Let me take a look here. So I'm going to recommend a trilogy, which you may have not heard of. And the first book is called Jade City. It's by Fonda Lee. The whole series is called the Greenbone Saga. This is such an awesome urban fantasy series. So I had a rough start with this series. I've actually first read it 5 years ago. I tried to pick it up, but I stopped 30% through. Because I just wasn't in the right state of mind. This is about, it's Asian fantasy. It's urban fantasy. It takes place on a fictional world, and it's about it's kind of like a mob crime, book, setting with these two clans that control a kind of an island nation, like a nation state. And it's the book, the Greenbone Saga is about these warring clans. And there's this magic system where they put jade on their skin, and it gives them some magical abilities, like with combat and perception and things like that. The reason these books are so good is so Fonda Lee is an incredible writer. She draws you into the world really very, very quickly. But the politics and the relationships that happen, the things that these characters are forced to face, the terrible violence of this culture. And then she expands it out in the following books, Jade War and Jade Legacy. And it gets a lot of geopolitics are involved. And how it relates to this clan on this one island. This is one of my favorite fantasy series I've ever read. I highly recommend you read it. And it even has a couple of novellas, which I've read almost all. There's two novellas. I just finished one of them and I have one more to go, but I'm going to savor it because it's so good. So I highly recommend it. The Greenbone Saga. The first one's called Jade City by Fonda Lee. If you get about halfway through it and you're not into it, then you probably won't like it, but pick it up. Highly recommend you pick it up. And then I want to mention just one more book that I just finished called this is also another Asian fantasy book. It's called The Grace of Kings by Ken Liu. It's been on my radar for a long time, but it got backlogged for a while. But I finally finished the first. It's a four-book series, and I only read the first one. It's a retelling of the Han Dynasty in China, which is a history that I don't really know anything about. But it didn't affect my enjoyment of the book. I overall really, really enjoyed this book, and I'm definitely going to read the next. It's weirdly written, like the pacing and the characters. It's more of a character. It's more of a plot-driven book. It is heavy with the characters, but like it's weird. Like months and years can pass by in the blink of an eye, and it's like jarring at the beginning because you don't really know what's going on. And the presentation of the characters is a little unorthodox. But it wasn't really till I was about 70% through. This is about like a, 600, 700 page book. I realized that what this book is about, it's a rivalry between two men, which represent tradition and heterodoxy, or like conservatism versus progressivism. And these ideologies are represented through these two men, Mata and Kuni. They're both extremely interesting characters. Mata is like the battle hungry man born in an honor culture. And Kuni is like a gangster, a drunk slob who gains his power by appealing to like the everyman and selectively uses his compassion. The relationship between these two characters and how it evolves is like the centerpiece of the book, and it's really well done. The other supporting characters were phenomenal. There's a Gia, who's Kuni's wife. There's another character named Luan, who's an inventor. And then there's Jin, who's a woman general who upends gender expectations and really gains the strategic advantage because she's a woman and because women are underestimated in this honor culture. It was a great cast, although the characterization was a little superficial and a little rushed. And then the Chinese fantasy world is really rich, immersive, and the politics between imperialism and warlord factions was just awesome. The branding and rebranding of authoritarianism and egalitarianism was really well done. The morality of the characters was extremely ambiguous. Like, it's not really a moral character in this story. And it was really realistic, which I enjoyed. No one is really a paragon of virtue here. But there are some that may be able to accomplish moral ideas better than others. Anyway, very much loved this book. So it's called The Grace of Kings by Ken Liu. So anyway, there's some good Asian fantasy books to check out. Anyway, thanks for listening. My email is icudrecmo@gmail.com. Email me anytime, and I'll see you next time. Thanks.